I am Tom Robbins, and I am, I haven't decided that yet in total, but right now I'm passing myself off as a novelist.
And the most dangerous writer in the world, right?
I've been called, yes, by Italy's leading literary critic as the most dangerous writer in the world. My all-time favorite quotation.
How did you get started with writing and words and letters?
Well, I committed myself to writing before I was old enough to know any better. For better or for worse, I hitched my little red wagon to the language wheel at a very early age. I actually began to talk and walk at 9 or 10 months. And my mother, when I was still a toddler, maybe a year old, maybe slightly older, but still in diapers and rompers, she would take me to town, and the shopkeepers and assorted other citizens and even tourists would give me penny candy or popsicles to bribe me to talk, because they found it so astounding that someone so little, still walking around in diapers, could speak in complete sentences. Wow. So I think that somewhere in the deep recesses of my little pea brain, I got the idea that language has power, that words have power, and not only that, but that they can garnish rewards, that using words can be rewarded. And this was in Blowing Rock, North Carolina, the highest incorporated town east of the Rockies, in Appalachia. So I was this talking toddler until I discovered the written word, which astonished me. And I think I could detect the potential power in that right away, because I fell in love with books immediately. Before I could actually read the words, I knew that those glyphs on the wood pulp actually represented words. And that absolutely enchanted me. And I fell in love with books. I loved just the way they looked, the way they felt in the hands, the weight of them, the way they smelled, like everything about them. And I decided that that's what I wanted to do with my life. And it was not until I was 5 that I told my parents that I was going to be a writer.
Ah.
I made that announcement. And for my 5th birthday, I received a Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs scrapbook. But instead of pasting pictures in it, I put in stories. Mm-hmm. Now, I couldn't actually write the stories down myself, but I would dictate them to my mother. And she was very encouraging, and she would stop whatever she was doing at the time, ironing or washing dishes or whatever, and take dictation whenever the muse came upon me. But my mother had been a frustrated writer and actually won a scholarship at Columbia University, but was afraid to move to New York and became a nurse instead. But she had had some literary ambition, so sometimes she would change the wording of the stories I had dictated, and I always knew. I remember verbatim what I had said, and I would throw a tantrum until she would restore it the way that I had dictated it.
And
I told that to my editor in New York once, and he said, my God, Robbins, you haven't changed in 40 years. So those stories still exist, by the way. That scrapbook is still in existence.
You have it?
I do not have it. One or other of my twin sisters have it. Yeah. And they each blame the other, so I don't know that I'll ever see it again. And I don't know what they think they're going to do with it. They think that they must think it's going to have some value someday. Poor deluded siblings. But although I began writing at age 5, I didn't get published until I was 7.
Oh, no, that late?
I was a late bloomer.
Oh, yeah, okay.
So I wrote a story, and I was in second grade in a large consolidated high school. The first grade through 12th grade was all in the same building. It was a 3-story building, and the school had a newspaper, of course, and it was edited by the seniors and juniors, and the newspaper office was up on the 3rd floor. Second grade was down practically in the basement. But I took my story and I trudged up those 3 flights of stairs and I went into the editorial office and I slapped it down on the desk and I said to the editor, "Print this." And they did. And I thought, well, that was easy. Maybe I could do this for a living. So I continued to write after that.
Well, okay. You didn't get a rejection note on your first published piece, but did you ever get a rejection note?
I've had only a couple.
Ah.
I very foolishly sent a poem into the New Yorker once, which they expect wisely declined to publish. And when I was in college, I sent a short story to Esquire, which was also rejected. But later in life, I was a regular contributor to Esquire, so I got my revenge.
All right.
But I, at a very early age, I decided that what I wanted to do in this world was to surprise and entertain and enlighten myself and others by telling stories that had never been told in a style that defied categorization. And that pretty much is how I operate today. If I hadn't expressed my goals today, if you put a gun to my head and said, "What are your goals as a writer?" I would say that I want to twine what I do is twine ideas and images into big subversive pretzels of life, death, and goofiness on the chance that they might help keep the world lively and give it the flexibility to endure.
So,
well, it's one thing to tell a good story, and we human beings define ourselves through narration. Maybe the first complete sentence that was ever spoken was not "I'm cold" or "Mother help me" or "What's for dinner, honey" or "How much is that saber-toothed tiger in the window?" But tell me a story. But it's one thing to tell a story, tell a good story. A lot of almost all aspiring writers think they have stories to tell. Have a good story to tell, and a few of them are correct. But it's a well-told story is different. A good story is not the same thing as a well-told story. And to tell a story in such a way that it's not only riveting in a narrative sense, but that delights and excites the psyche of the reader is on a whole nother level, and that's the level that I guess I aspire to.
Your first novel.
I had a dream since the age of 4 or 5 to write novels. But I had pushed that onto the back burner in my teens and 20s, thinking perhaps it was an impossible dream, but it was always there, lurking in the background. And I had a second dream, or maybe just a crazy vision, that someday I would receive a letter in the mail that would change my life.
Mm-hmm.
And there would be a golden aura around this letter, and I would open it, and everything would be irrevocably altered after that. It's not something I thought about day and night. It was back there down there in the green ooze at the bottom of my brain pan. But I was living in Seattle over top of a machine shop, and one day I went downstairs and got the mail, and there was a letter with the return address was Doubleday and Company. So I opened it and read it on the way up the stairs, and when I got back to my apartment, I said to my girlfriend, I just got the letter. Can you see there's a golden R around it? And the letter was from Luther Nichols, who was the West Coast editor of Doubleday. He worked out of San Francisco, I believe, or Berkeley. And he had been reading my art columns. I was an art critic of the Seattle Times. Mm-hmm. And he had been reading my columns, and he said that when he was coming to Seattle in 2 weeks, and he would like to meet with me and discuss the possibility of a book. So my thyroid was pumping when I went to meet him for lunch at the coffee shop at the Benjamin Franklin Hotel. And it turned out that what Mr. Nichols had in mind was a book about Northwest art. So I was disappointed. And tried to conceal it, but I had to say, well, maybe, but what I really would like to do is give you a novel. And then it was his turn to be disappointed. But he was a very courtly gentleman, and he said, well, okay, tell me something about this novel. And I said, well, it involves the discovery of the mummified body of Jesus Christ in the catacombs underneath the Vatican, its theft, and subsequent reappearance in a roadside zoo in the Pacific Northwest. And he perked up at that point.
As anybody would.
And he said, well, very interesting, tell me more. But you see, I didn't know anymore. That's all I had. I'd been carrying that tidbit around for several years. So I started improvising a plot. And I didn't get too far, and I told him what I could get away with. And he said, well, yes, I find this interesting. When can I see it? And I said, well, it's kind of rough at the moment, because I hadn't written a single word of it. And I went home that day and told my girlfriend, I now have to write a novel. And it took me about a year to extricate myself from the Seattle art world, and I finally did, and moved to the country where I could literally steal spinach and cauliflower and cabbage out of the fields at night, and midnight produce runs. I mean, we subsisted on that and what my girlfriend brought home from the seafood restaurant in which she worked. We lived on stolen produce and slops de mer. And I wrote 30 pages, which I thought was a pretty good start, and I sent it down to Luther Nichols, and he sent it on to New York. And the junior editors were intrigued. The senior editors wanted no part of it. And I found out about that time that Doubleday and Company had begun as a Roman Catholic publishing house. So naturally, this plot line wasn't a big attraction to the older editors. But Luther encouraged me to continue, as did the younger editors in New York, and so I wrote 70 more pages, and I sent 100 pages off, and then went back to New York, and pretty much the same reaction. The younger editors really liked it. The senior editors didn't see any value in it. So they refused to give me an advance. So I had to continue stealing cabbages and cauliflower and eating shrimp off of other diners' platters. And but by then, I was into it. I mean, it had taken over my life. So there was no way I could stop at that point. So I finished it, and sent it back to New York, and it was somewhat the same reaction, except the younger editors prevailed. they championed it to such an extent that Doubleday sent me a contract and a $2,500 advance, which would buy a lot of cabbages and cauliflower.
Yeah.
So it was published in 1971. They only printed 6,000 copies. And it was not an overnight success. In fact, I don't think a great many of those hardcover copies were sold. I've seen them, nowadays I see them on eBay for anywhere from $1,200 to $2,500.
Yeah.
I didn't save any. I gave them, most of them away to young women I was trying to impress. And I have to say, it was totally worth it.
Yeah.
But, about that time, an editor at Ballantine Books, which was a mass market paperback publisher exclusively, was given a stack of books to take home over the weekend to read to see if there were any one of them that she might recommend to Ballantine to republish in a drugstore rack size paperback. Her name was Leonore Fleischer, and I worship her as one of the true angels of my life. She stacked up six books by the side of her bed, got in bed, lit up a joint, got a little stoned, and then looked the books over, and whoosh, right away her eyes went to the cover of Another Roadside Attraction. Understandable. So she picked it up and she began reading, and on Monday she went back to Ballantine and said to Ian Ballantine, we need to republish this book. And they did, and
in paperback,
and small mass market paperbacks, and it almost went out of print several times, but the word of mouth kept growing and the books kept selling just enough copies to stay in print. And it went on and on, and, you know, 2011 is still in print.
Yeah. How many prints has it gone through, do you know?
I have no idea.
Why?
But, see, I had no agent at the time, so my royalties were a cent and a half a copy.
Oh.
So I haven't exactly bought a big house in the south of France with the proceeds from that, even though it sold more than a million copies.
And that book set your reputation as a novelist because, among other things, you sort of redefined what a novel was.
I had to redefine the novel. My subject matter, among various philosophical, political, sexual, I had a vast array of subjects I wanted to explore, but it was going to be set in the 60s, and what I wanted to do was to recreate the 60s on the page. I realized intuitively that the traditional novel could not really capture the 60s. It was too much mythology in action. It was a very mythological period, and it was turbulent, and it had nuances that simply could not be captured in the old repertorial style. In a traditional novel, you would climb an inclined plane from minor climax to minor climax to major climax. Well, this wouldn't work for a novel that really captured the 60s, so I wrote it episodically in little flashes, like little flashes that someone might get when they're stoned, or little flashes that you might get from listening to music.
Yeah.
They were like beads, little beads that were strung like beads, and didn't. Even though there was a narrative drive, you couldn't necessarily follow it up an inclined plane because it was happening here and it was happening there. just the way the 60s were happening. And so some of those episodes would illuminate the plot, and others were designed merely to illuminate the reader, to create a certain mindset in the reader that was congruent with the mindset that many of us were in the 60s.
Subsequent to that was Even Cowgirls Get the Blues. That was your second, right?
Even Cowgirls Get the Blues.
Which is even, if I remember correctly, was even more of that episodic throbbing of images and little pieces, vignettes that built into a story.
Yeah, Even Cowgirls Get the Blues was written episodically, but more it was less radical than Another Roadside Attraction. Mm-hmm. There were lots of little vignettes that built up into stories and a major story and character studies, etc. But it was a little more traditional. It was postmodernist or postmodernist in a way, in that it was often or occasionally self-referential. Hmm. I would interrupt the narrative flow, and I, the writer, would intrude upon the story, but in such a way, I hoped, that would not diminish the story, but instead, in some subliminal way, would enhance it.
Do your characters, as you're writing, do they ever take over? Do they ever take control? Do they ever speak to you, or are you always... Are they truly your puppets as characters?
Well, I wouldn't describe them as my characters as puppets. It takes me 2.5 to 3 years to write a novel, and so I spend a lot of time with them, and they do become like family in a way. Mm-hmm. And like families, you love some of them and you hate some of them. But I pretty much stay in control of them. I don't let them take over and dictate the story. I think the closest analogy to writing a novel, at least the way I do it, is downhill skiing. And when you ski downhill, you have to give yourself over to gravity. You give yourself over to the mountain and let it take you and let it increase your speed. But at the same time, you use your poles and you use your body English to exhibit a certain amount of control, or else you're going to go crashing head over heels and end up in a hospital with broken limbs or worse. So it's the same with writing a novel, I think, in that you give yourself over to wild abandon, but at the same time you maintain enough control to make it intellectually and philosophically and psychologically engage the reader.
Yeah. The mechanics of how you write. Do you use so computer or cast bones on the floor? Or?
Physically, I write in longhand. I write very slowly, sentence by sentence. And there's no need for me to use a computer to compose. Now, eventually it does get put on a computer, and I'm not a Luddite. I use the internet a lot for research, and it's been a great boon to me in that regard. But I write on yellow legal pads, and I go into my writing room. When I'm actually working on a novel, I go in every day around 10 o'clock. And my muse always knows where to find me. Mm-hmm. She doesn't have to go look in the bars or go to the beach or check the boulevards. 10 o'clock, she knows I'll be there. Now, she doesn't always show up, but she's fickle that way. But I'm there.
Yeah.
And sitting around waiting for inspiration is for amateurs and dilettantes. If you're a professional writer, you pack your lunch and you go to work every day. There were people in college with me who had just as much talent as I had, were just as good a writer as I were, but they never did anything with it because they didn't have the drive. They got married too young, they got a mortgage, they took on such a big load of bananas that they could barely walk, and so their talent never got utilized, never materialized in anything. No, I don't keep a journal, and I don't. I never write down what I think is a good line or a clever metaphor. They are generated by the actual work of writing. They come out of the work itself. Sometimes a metaphor will just pop into my head, but always during the act of writing. I don't have a little notebook in which I write down what I think are clever similes or metaphors. When I use a metaphor, I try to use it advisedly and never arbitrarily. I try to use it in a way that will heat up a scene, that will actually deepen the reader's understanding of the place, the person, the thing, the scene that they are encountering on the page. So the metaphor has in some way to enlarge the paragraph or the particular scene, even if it seems to jump out of a trap door and yell in surprise, it's still, I hope, done in such a way that it enriches what I have been writing about on that page or in that paragraph. So it's not a gimmick. I mean, people have said it's a gimmick, but I mean, was Hemingway's short sentences a gimmick? That was the way Hemingway saw the world. Faulkner's long, convoluted sentences, were they a gimmick? No. That's the way Faulkner viewed the world. That's the way it came through his web of language. Metaphors, particularly unexpected metaphors, are a way that I see the world. It's part of what I would call, perhaps pretentiously, a poetic vision of things. To be able to, say, walk down the aisle in the supermarket and see a can of Red Devil Lye and connect that to 13th century Christianity. And there is a connection there, but if you maintain that kind of awareness, then these things pop up all the time, and I think that they can enrich fiction and probably nonfiction. Yeah. I use metaphors in nonfiction as well, though not as often, I suppose. Yeah, I only write one draft, and a lot of academics look askance at that. A lot of other writers look askance at that. But I revise as I go along. It's not that I haven't revised. It doesn't come out of me in streams. It isn't an eruption as it is with some writers. It comes out of my brain pan, one sentence at a time, and I try never to leave a sentence until it's as good as I think I can make it within this context. And it's a very painstaking way to work, and it requires immense focus and concentration. But when I'm done, I'm done, because it's been revised as I go along. There's not a word in any one of my novels that I haven't read over probably 25 or 30 times. Mm-hmm. So it's a mistake to think that it just flows out of me and I send it off to the publisher.
Yeah.
Now, I'll change words and sometimes even phrases, maybe even a sentence, right up till they lock it on the presses. I guess they don't do that anymore. But right until the last minute, I'll be changing words here, there, and everywhere. But I never have to go back and rewrite a whole section of plot. because I'm squeezing this plot out like toothpaste from a tube all during that 3 years that I've been writing the book. Well, this is my writing room.
Uh-huh.
And I usually begin writing sitting down here on the sofa with my yellow legal pad. And
working longhand.
Always in longhand. And I like to write very slowly. I like to watch that ink soak into the wood pulp. And as you can see, my handwriting resembles the nasty scrawls chalked on alley walls by Mongolian monster boys. But okay, it gets transcribed eventually.
And then do you...
And I'll move over here to this Coca-Cola desk for a while, and then to change the furniture in my room, in my head, I'll move over to this desk. So I move around, change posture. A writer needs to spend a lot of time alone. And you need to embrace the joys of solitude. At least that's my opinion.
Right. So forth, to give advice to young writers, aspiring writers. Got some?
Yeah, sure, I have advice. So my first piece of advice would be stop worrying about getting published and concentrate on getting better.
Nice.
Because if you make your book good enough, then it will take care of itself.
Nice.
It will get published. Secondly, you should challenge every sentence you write. Challenge it for accuracy, challenge it for clarity, challenge it for imagination, you know, its delight level. Challenge it for cadence, because people read with their ears as well as with their eyes. And all good writing has a rhythm, just like the best of music. And then I would advise them to, if they're not already in love with language, take language out on a date and see if you can't get some chemistry going. See if you can't hook up and become a couple. Because books and stories are made of words. Every writer, every aspiring writer thinks he or she has a good story to tell. But having a good story is not the same thing as a well-told story. And well-told stories depend on your use of words.
And work.
Words and work, yeah. So, I don't read reviews of my books, but someone told me that a reviewer in the New York Times wrote once that Robbins needs to decide whether he wants to be funny or serious. And I said, okay, well, I'll decide when God decides. Life is simultaneously funny and serious. And the comic sensibility opens doors in consciousness that are closed to people who are sober and prudent. A comic situation can be the most desperate of all situations. It's a high humor is a desperately serious transcendence of evil.
It's enough that you take my breath away in writing, but you do it here verbally in front of me. It's impressive beyond belief.
I'm not very articulate in conversation, which is one reason why I do write. I was never able to say the things I really wanted to say in the way that I wanted to say them in conversation. Yeah. It gets worse as time goes by and the years pass, and I have to have that writing implement and that piece of wood pulp in order to get things to come out right.
Yeah. Mr. Robbins, this has been magnificent. I appreciate it so much. Your insights and sharing have just been great. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome. I'm honored that you chose to include me, and I hope I said something worth hearing.
Probably 12 or 13 seconds we can get it down to.
Okay.
Yeah, it's been brilliant.